Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Joseph Fahey. He's a judge in the Onondaga County court system and an adjunct law professor at Syracuse University. But the reason he's here with me today is that he's also the author of the book, James K. McGuire, Boy Mayor and Irish Nationalist, about Syracuse's mayor from 1896 to 1901. Judge Fahey, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, how did you come to the decision to write a book on James McGuire?
It started as a project that was requested by the Irish American Cultural Institute. They were going to do an anthology of Irish early Irish American leaders in the county, and they knew I was related to them, so they asked me to write a profile. And I wrote the profile. They didn't do the anthology, and I took it to the American Conference of Irish Studies in New York and delivered it as a paper down there. And Jim McKillop at Syracuse University Press was in the audience and wanted to know if I'd turn it into a biography, and I agreed to do it.
And what's the nature of your connection to him?
He was my mother's uncle. He was my great-uncle.
Ah, interesting.
My grandfather's older brother.
And so what, though, made you want to actually devote all the time that you did to write the book? I mean, you were solicited for it, but is it time and place of your life? What made you decide, I'm going to do this?
Well, from the profile, I thought he was a pretty fascinating character. He had so many different chapters in his life, both as mayor of Syracuse. He was pretty prominent on the national stage in Democratic politics and statewide politics. And then he became a very close confidant of Emma de Valera's. And he was, you know, involved in the Irish independence movement, both above and below the radar screen. So I thought he was pretty interesting, and I wanted to learn more about him.
I want to come back to some of those things you just mentioned, but tell me how you went about researching his life.
It was quite an undertaking because he didn't leave any papers or diaries or correspondence or anything behind. So I wound up going into the archives at City Hall and copying some of the correspondence from his administration. I spent probably a couple of years of nights and weekends in the local history section of the library, and I pretty much had a day-by-day account of his 6 years as mayor of Syracuse. I was able to access the American-Irish Historical Society's archives, and then I was able to get cooperation from Congressman Walsh about the congressional investigations he was involved in, and the archivists at Emma de Valera's papers in Ireland were very helpful too. So in the end, I was able to put together a pretty good picture of his life.
Now, why did he not leave anything of his own?
I think because he had this, what I call, above-the-radar, below-the-radar existence. He was involved in a very secret organization called Clonagale that raised money for the Irish Republican Brotherhood. He was involved in some gun-running activities of his own. And I think that because he had this sort of clandestine role in his life, he deliberately didn't keep these things.
Now, I read in your book that as a boy, McGuire was sent to German school because they had the best reputation at the time, but that the instruction was in German. How common was that then in the schools?
I don't know exactly how common it was at that point. I mean, the schools he went to were really offered by the Lutheran churches on the north side. He became fluent in German, and he actually could campaign in German. He could talk to German audiences in their native tongue, which was pretty effective at the time.
And what struck me about reading that was, I guess, when it came to education, this notion of English as the universal language, you know, the part of the politics that we're here today, that hadn't taken hold, at least when it came to instruction, I suppose.
No, there didn't seem to be this kind of nativist approach to things. But, I mean, ultimately, when he finished his grammar school education, he and my grandfather went to the early version of CBA, and I think that was taught in English, and that was their last formal schooling.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Judge Joe Fahey, the author of a biography of Syracuse Mayor James McGuire. You describe how, in the book, as a young man, persuasive public speaking emerged as one of his primary skills. Aside from being Irish, what gave James McGuire that skill?
That's a good question. It really is, because when he died, he was considered to be at one point the greatest orator the county had ever produced. His mother was very, very involved in continuing his education even after they had to leave to support the family. And she homeschooled him and homeschooled him very well, forced him to read the classics. He had a pretty inquisitive mind, and I think he just had the natural speaking ability.
Hmm. And how did he make his living before he was elected mayor?
He had started as a stock clerk at Bradford & Kennedy, which was a dry goods business here in the city of Syracuse, and worked his way up to becoming a partner in the firm. He accomplished that by the time he was in his early 20s. My grandfather was the same way. He formed his own insurance agency at the age of 19. So he was pretty successful. He had a pretty good head for business too.
And you mentioned earlier that this German that he learned came in handy on the campaign trail. Tell me about the campaign more generally. How did he go about running for mayor?
He had actually been approached by the Democratic Party before he was 21 years old to run for school commissioner and assemblyman, and he declined both nominations. And after he was responsible, as was my grandfather, with the support of the family because of my great-grandfather's depression after one of the kids drowned. And so after my great-grandfather died and he established himself in business, he decided to run for mayor, and he ran an insurgent campaign, got the nomination on the Democratic side as an insurgent, and then ran against a divided Republican Party.
Now, you have some really interesting descriptions of media coverage of the campaign, and that sort of, you know, you can see the future of the Syracuse newspapers and all of these. Can you tell me a little bit about how the mass media worked at that time?
Well, Syracuse actually had 12 newspapers that came out multiple times a day. And each of the Republican factions had kind of their house organ. The Syracuse Standard was one. The Democratic house organ would have been the Syracuse Courier. And the campaigns were largely conducted through the newspapers. There were some rallies and some speeches, but their position papers and their broadsides and their attacks on one another largely occurred through the media.
Now, when he becomes mayor, going by your description, he sounds to me like a pretty activist mayor in terms of what he accomplished, all the things that he did in the 6 years that he had in office. In particular, he was a builder. You write that he was responsible for 38 schools during his three-term tenure. The terms were 2 years back then. And also responsible for a lot of street paving, which was very significant back then in terms of economic development, in addition to being a key figure in the first Everson Museum and the Carnegie Library,
yes,
among other places. So tell me a little bit about what informed that nature of his approach to being a mayor.
I think he always recognized, both from having had to leave school as a child, the value of education. I mean, he was fortunate that my great-grandmother educated him the way he did. But he also saw that if you didn't invest in education, you were going to – and especially going in the aftermath of the Panic of 1893 – you were going to have some pretty, devastated, depressing, homeless people in the city. I mean, he was very concerned about that. He's very concerned about offering constructive programming both in the Onondaga County Penitentiary. So I think he really placed a real value on education. And he had a special love for the library. He was a trustee of the library before he was mayor. It was the only other public office he ever held.
And I was curious about this in regard to the education as to how much of this impulse to build and to create this additional educational infrastructure, was that kind of the impulse of the times, sort of where the city was in terms of its development, or was this really his initiative pushing this forward?
I think it was a combination of both things. I think that the city was at that developmental stage where this was going to be necessary to have the extensive kind of school system that they had. But he did have – I mean, his devotion to education was such that he and my grandfather were able to put their two younger siblings through Notre Dame, which was pretty unusual at the turn of the last century. So they really did see the value of education.
Now, in those days too, all across the country and all of the different urban centers – ethnic politics was really big. Did he, as mayor, try to create patronage for Irish Americans? Irish aspect play out?
He did create patronage for the Irish, but I have to say about McGuire, he created patronage for anybody who was for him. So he didn't discriminate along ethnic lines. If you were German or you were or Irish, he and you were a backer of his, he would find something for you.
And what were the big ethnic divisions at that time that he might have been dealing with in Syracuse?
I would say it was largely a division between the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant population and the ethnic groups. Okay. The Irish and the Germans were very and the Jewish community was very involved in politics to a lesser degree. The Italian-American community. One of the interesting things about him is he was the first Democrat to get the endorsement of the only African-American newspaper in town because he had acknowledged that they had not been well treated by prior city administrations. So he now, you know, there's a certain patronage side of that too, in the sense that he was looking for votes. But he did reach out to that community and he did get support from it.
Now, you're a Democrat. This gentleman was a Democrat. Are Fahey's all Democrats and McGuire's all Democrats?
Yeah, we are. Somebody once said to me that they wondered if I was going to become a Republican. I said, if there's going to be a Republican Fahey in heaven someday, it's going to be somebody other than me.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Judge Joseph Fahey. And we've been discussing his new book titled James K. McGuire, Boy Mayor and Irish Nationalist. McGuire was Syracuse's mayor around the turn of the 20th century. Now, when you read your book, you come across a host of iconic characters whose names are still with us today in the city on buildings and other important things. Hendrix, Hancock, Kirk, Maddie, others of that nature. Do you think it says anything as a metaphor, perhaps, that we don't seem to have the same number of names like that from the last 30 years permanently etched into the Syracuse infrastructure?
I think there's a lot of validity to that. You know, the last major structure that I can think of that was named after a former public office holder was Corcoran High School. Mm-hmm. And that was built in 1967. I don't know. I mean, it may be that there's a lack of new construction, so the opportunity to name things isn't quite there. But that is, I thought that was kind of ironic. The other thing I found kind of unusual is for a guy who built 38 schools, there's no building in Syracuse named after McGuire. And I think that had to do with the fact that for the next 40 or 50 years after he was mayor, there was no Democratic administrations. I think they were always worried that he would come back and run for mayor again, so they tried to freeze him out of the existence. I mean, they named one school after the Republican commissioner of jurors, Salem Hyde. But no McGuire High School, no McGuire Elementary School.
That's telling. What ultimately defeated him as mayor?
I think there was a certain amount of McGuire fatigue. You know, he'd had three terms. He had seemed to be he seemed to acknowledge that he had his focus had become devoted to running for governor, and that became a distraction from Syracuse, and he thought that hurt him with the Syracuse populace. And then the Republicans, you know, they indicted him in the middle of his second term and created a legislative committee that took all of the city's prior debt and put it into one budget, raising the tax rate. So they worked pretty hard to defeat him.
Was that a legitimate indictment? I mean, you hear today a phrase of the criminalization of politics, that being if you want to get at someone on the other side, you'll try to figure out something you can bring charges about. It sounds like that was going on.
It was a classic example of that. He tried to become the candidate for governor in 1899. I'm sorry, 1898. He lost the nomination at the Democratic State Convention to Augustus Van Wyck. Van Wyck was defeated by 17,000 votes, and the Democrats recognized if they'd run McGuire, they would have won. He would have defeated Theodore Roosevelt for governor. Roosevelt appointed a special prosecutor within the next year to come to Syracuse and investigate finances and had him indicted.
So let me move on to post-mayor activities. He was a strong proponent of Irish independence. You mentioned that earlier. And that led him to advocate that the U.S. should side with the Germans in World War I because the Germans were backing the Irish rebels, I think, among other reasons. And he wrote some well-known and controversial books at the time, The King, The Kaiser, and Irish Freedom, and another one, What Germany Could Do for Ireland. And he also housed and supported Irish rebels, as you mentioned earlier. Did he ever rethink any of those positions before his death in 1923 after World War I?
I don't think he ever rethought those positions, and he certainly didn't apologize for them. What he did say, because he did become the subject of a congressional investigation into propaganda at the conclusion of World War I, and his position was that at the time America entered the war on the side of the British, he withdrew his books from the market, raised money for the American and British war effort, and was a loyal American. But up to the point where America was entering the war, he felt that the Irish would do better if Germany prevailed over Britain.
Now, as his biographer, what do you make of those positions that he took?
I don't think they were out of the mainstream for the Irish Fenian movement at the time. I think that one of the reasons the League of Nations went down to defeat was because the Irish-American community became so well organized, because they recognized that Ireland would not do well under the League of Nations, that the question of Irish sovereignty would be left to the British. And you have to remember that from the day of the 1916 Rising, the Irish Republicans and the Irish Americans viewed Ireland as a republic, not as a colony of Britain. So I don't think he would ever apologize for those positions, and I don't think his positions were out of the mainstream for the Irish-American leadership at the time.
That's interesting because, you know, what you've got there in a way is you're putting the interests of the Irish question above the American question in terms of World War I, at least as it's articulated. You know, once we come into the war, and obviously who we were backing and who our allies were. If you think about that through the lens of politics today, that would be a really, really chancy kind of move to make.
Oh, it would, and it was. I mean, Wilson so loathed the Irish American leadership that he turned the forerunner of the FBI loose, and a number of them were charged with sedition and treason. Teddy Roosevelt recommended they all be interned during World War I.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Judge Joseph Fahey. Well, I also wanted to ask you a couple questions about your day job.
Sure.
You're a judge in the Onondaga County court system. How long have you sat on the bench, and what kinds of cases typically come before you?
I've been on the bench since January 1st of 1997, and I've handled almost exclusively felony-level criminal cases. I also handle annual reviews of civilly committed sex offenders under Article 10 of the Mental Hygiene Law. But I would say 90% of my work is presiding over criminal trials.
And are there any particular insights about law or society that this experience of being a judge has given you?
I still believe that probably the greatest thing we can do to avoid young people growing up to fall into lives of crime is to educate them and train them in ways that they can enter the workforce productively. H.G. Wells once said that history was a race between education and catastrophe, and I think that holds true from what I see on the bench every day.
Well, you're sounding like James K. McGuire, I think, the focus on education. Now, I know you're limited in what you can say about individual cases, but I was curious to know whether there are cases that stick in your mind where you look back and think, I think we may have gotten that one wrong.
I can't really think of anything that I would look at and say it came out wrong. When I was teaching at the law school, I always used to tell my students, juries never make mistakes. Judges make mistakes. Lawyers make mistakes. Cops make mistakes. Witnesses make mistakes. But juries are pretty good about putting their collective heads together and coming up with the right result. Maybe they heard something they shouldn't have, or maybe they didn't hear something they should have. But I think juries do a great job, and I can't really point to any case that I've had in the 16 years and say, I think it should have come out differently.
Mm. And thinking about the criminal justice system itself, if you could change one thing about that that's actually possible to imagine that it might change, what would it be?
I think I would probably say it would be wise to give judges more discretion over nonviolent cases in which drugs and alcohol are a problem, to offer more treatment options than are out there. I think we're starting to see a lot of good work done in those areas, but I'm not sure that we'll ever keep up with the number of cases coming through.
Yeah, my impression was that Syracuse actually has done some things about that.
They have.
That.
We've got a treatment court.
Tell me a little bit about that.
No, we have a treatment court, and cases can go into that, either being diverted into treatment court at the beginning of the case, or sometimes what can happen is a defendant will plead guilty to an offense and then have the case transferred to treatment court. And it's a carrot and stick approach. If they're successful, they get further consideration, and if they're not, then they get sentenced accordingly. I just wished we had done it sooner. I wish the New York State Legislature had reformed the drug laws sooner because I think that there was a whole generation of people that went off to state prison because of laws that were utterly too harsh when it came to drugs.
And come back to the book again with just a couple quick things. Is there an upcoming book launch for your biography of James McGuire that you want our listeners to know about?
Yes, there is. The Onondaga Historical Association and the Irish American Cultural Institute are going to host a book launch at the Onondaga Historical Association on May 21st from 4:30 to 6, and it's open to the public, and I hope everybody will come.
Great. And has this experience of writing this book whetted your appetite for future book-type projects?
It has. I do enjoy writing. I enjoyed writing as a judge and as a professor, and I've now kind of branched out into different areas of Irish and Irish American history, and I kind of enjoy reading and researching and seeing if there's enough material to do something.
Great. Let me get to the three questions. What's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I would call it Chapter 1 of the Second Edition. Fahey Revisited.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I get terribly, terribly impatient with people that I don't think are performing well in front of me.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
That in my 64th year, I'm taking piano lessons.
That was Joseph Fahey, and the book again is titled James K. McGuire, Boy Mayor and Irish Nationalist. Judge Fahey, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest. And you can now follow us on Twitter @CampbellConvos.